Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. It's Sunday, December 6, 2009. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host for Breaking the Sound Barriers of Disease. Most of our regular listeners know that I'm the pioneer of vocal profiling in human bioacoustics. Our guest host today also works with bioacoustic biology and several other modalities of alternative health. Chris Cordes is an engineer and a parent who began vaccinating his oldest son using the Center for Disease Control Schedule, the U.S. version. He then began investigating the outcomes of those vaccinations and stopped immunizing his son. Chris's youngest child has never been vaccinated, so Chris's experiences fits well with what we're going to do today. Welcome, Chris.
Hello.
And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about today how vaccinations are not safe and actually how they've been proven to be destructive to the brain. With us today on the show is an incredible physician, a researcher who's going to just blow the lid off the idea that our government and or Big Pharma knows what's best for us in terms of our health. So please stay tuned for that. This will be a very important hour of your life. As you learn that you are being blatantly lied to, your children are indiscriminately being used as guinea pigs, your pocketbooks are being raped, and all in the name of some arrogant, ignorant bureaucracy that makes laws and demands that they know what's best for you. You probably can tell that I'm on my soapbox. And I'm on my soapbox because I had two damaged grandchildren over these vaccinations. We have used our techniques here at the Sound Health Research Center in Albany, which is our sponsor for this show, to undo that damage. And so I kind of get a little preachy about what happens with vaccinations. The show, Breaking the Sound Barriers of Disease, is a show always dedicated to bringing you information and ideas from innovative leaders in the field of health and wellness. Actually, that's what our research is about at Sound Health. We're bridging the belief and science genres of what is going on in our lives. We're going to talk about that little belief system a little later on. But one of the things that we want to bring today is contrary to what these people who think they know best, don't want us to know, because it decreases their profits, and I don't know what else their motives are. Maybe we'll find out. Today's no exception. Dr. Andrew Molden is a Canadian, an MD, and in addition, he holds PhD concentrations in neurophysiology, combined with cognitive neuroscience. Dr. Molden's research has proven beyond any doubt, if you ever look at his website, he has proven beyond any doubt that vaccinations cause restricted blood flow to the brain. The results are many strokes, which have caused an overwhelming rise in autism, learning difficulties, attention deficit disorders, infant death syndrome, Gulf War syndrome, dementia, seizure disorders, and some cancers. Boy, that's a lot. Welcome to the show, Dr. Molden.
Good afternoon, Sherry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. You know, when I first heard about your work, it was from a very dedicated health practitioner, Carolyn Walker. And when she told me about your work, I said, thank God. Because Carolyn and I had been discussing some of our findings at the Institute here, and we were puzzled because we discovered, we didn't really understand what we discovered, that autistic kids had blood clotting and protein digestion issues, but we really didn't know what to do about it. There's nobody doing that research, no literature about it, but you did it. You brought all of this out. What made you want to look at that relationship between autism, brain damage, and vaccinations?
Well, I didn't want to go look at it, actually. In fact, it wasn't even on my agenda. All my years of academia, I was basically chasing schizophrenia. And that's over 13 and a half years of formal education in brain and behavior from every possible modality we have to look at the brain. And it was shortly coming out of medical school after the PhD that I was seeing the patients firsthand. Now, ironically, despite having studied the human brain from every angle I can think of, academically, book form, lectures, series, and clinically, autism wasn't even on my radar. Some studies from 87 right through to 2000 coming out of medical school. But when I started seeing the patients, the children, it was very clear to me that I could see firsthand with my own eyes and my understanding how the brain's functions are wired relative to and blood vessel territories, that I was seeing the equivalent of microscopic strokes. In medicine, we call it ischemia, impaired blood flow. And I was seeing the same damages there as I was seeing in my schizophrenic patients. And then that was my magical aha moment in 2001, in January. And since then to now, it was a matter of figuring out, well, why is this happening? How is it happening? And that's what we've achieved. And unfortunately, the truth now shows that it's not just vaccine-induced autism. It's a common mechanism to all human disease. It was always there, whether it was leprosy, bubonic plague, infectious diseases like smallpox, or, for that matter, Spanish flu. It's all the same problem.
Pneumonic plague is associated with many strokes?
Bubonic plague, yeah. So back in the 1800s, many people died with an exposure to bubonic plague. But if you went back and look at it, even while polio was doing the same thing as well, which is likely what was causing the paralysis, we called it infantile paralysis as well as the respiratory failure. Bubonic plague, if you go back and look at it, you'd see very clearly that the fingertips, nose tip, toe tips tend to turn black. It was called Black Death. And those are end blood vessel territories, not much different from what you see with frostbite. It goes to the end blood vessel territories, fingertip, nose tip, ear tips, toe tips, as does, for that matter, diabetes, which impairs blood flow, which takes out the foot tips and the kidneys, as well as the blood vessels in the eye. It's a common mechanism that's impairing blood flow systemically in the body because we've shown conclusively that the same damages that are happening neurologically to the brain before after vaccination, we see the same silent, measurable damages after a poisonous snake bite, whether it's a cobra to the bite to the leg, whether it's a common crate bite, or whether it's a West African gaboon viper. It's the same common mechanism that we never really realized was there.
Well, when you're talking about polio, well, three of these, polio, so the shots that they gave us for polio caused more polio?
Polio is, all these diagnostic labels, unfortunately. Bear in mind that the human body has 60,000 miles of capillaries, microscopic blood vessels, throughout the whole human body. It keeps us healthy, allows us to heal damaged tissues, and keeps us alive. But when with those 60,000 miles of end small blood vessels throughout the whole body, if they start being derailed or blocked, any organ system, brain or body, then it will impair blood flow and lead to some sort of symptom-based diagnostic labels. And diagnostic labels are not really the cause of disease. So you can call polio with a name associated with a bug and say that it, paralysis or, for that matter, respiratory failure seems to be what we call polio. So if you give a vaccination and you get rid of respiratory failure and clinically obvious paralysis, you say, congratulations, guys, we eradicated polio. But consider polio and its symptoms like dropping a ketchup bottle on the floor in your kitchen. The glass shards on the floor, as well as the ketchup on the floor, we called that polio. So we gave the vaccine to everybody, and we got rid of the glass shards, as well as the ketchup, and we say, congratulations, we eradicated polio from the world, but then all of a sudden, look over here. What's this? Now we call it lumpy carpet disease and put any other label to it, and now it's bleeding ketchup, and we've just given it different diagnostic labels from aseptic meningitis to autism to ADHD to learning disabilities. It's all the same problem because polio was silently inducing the same brain damages from end vascular territories that our contemporary brain imaging tools cannot pick up. It's beneath the resolution that we see commonly now, still there for everybody. It never went away. We just changed the symptoms and changed the labels, but it's the same problem.
Well, I can relate to this as vaccinations and polio. How would you relate that to diabetes? Because there's no vaccination for diabetes.
Yeah, so unfortunately we've developed a mindset in Western medicine and the public at large that we assume A goes to B, like one bug, one germ equals one disease, or one group of symptoms equals one disease. But by analogy, each disease label that we give out there in Western medicine, across the board, every organ system, stands as its own clinical label, diagnostic label, that has very specific symptoms to the organ by which it is primarily manifested from the damages. And we treat those symptoms as if it's causally related to the problem. But by analogy, each diagnostic label is like an individual card in a deck of 52 cards. You can call Crohn's, colitis, the ace of spades, or you can call dementia the queen of hearts, or autism the seven of diamonds. But when you can show conclusively across the board, beneath every diagnostic label, by and large, there's a same common mechanism and damages clinically measurable for every individual, irrespective of the diagnostic label comes out, it basically brings the system down from diagnostic labels, which is kind of in the clouds, down to the floor of the forest here and says, hey guys, there's a common mechanism here across the board, irrespective of what disease label comes out, and that's what we should be directing our attention at. And this is a blood flow problem, microscopic, that's beneath our radars.
Well, how can the common person take care of this? Is it food? Is it exercise? What should we be doing?
Well, great question. I don't profess to have all the answers here. But the literature beginning in the 1930s, it was beginning to show that there seems to be a common mechanism of pathology across a whole range of damages and diseases and disorders, infectious diseases included, was the work by Dr. Melvin Nisley, spelled K-N-I-S-L-E-Y. He was even profiled on the front page of Time magazine back at that time, and you can Google his name and go look for his work. He called it sludge blood. Whether it's malaria or any infectious disease whatsoever, he observed clinically and by direct observation of looking at the microscopic blood flow invasively and non-invasively by looking through the sides of the eyes with dissecting microscopes, he found that the blood was sludging together. And sludge blood, unfortunately, blood that sticks together like two balloons rub against your head, they stick together by static electricity, sludge blood does not fit through small end blood vessels, which are tinier than the red blood cells carrying oxygen. So by what's happening here is one part of the problem is that when the blood starts to stick together as part of its natural healing mechanism, that many of these end blood vessel territories throughout the body and brain, bowel, liver, kidney, pancreas, or brain for that matter, doesn't matter, are impaired for blood flow, and that means impaired oxygen. But because the brain cannot store oxygen, you've got 4 minutes, generally speaking, before you start having some irreversible tissue damages. So the problem here in solving it, what to do in the population as a whole, is first identifying and agreeing what the common problem is. And the common problem is not in diagnostic labels like Western medicine addresses. It's in the common cause of disease. And this common cause, one aspect of it, is electrophysiological. It involves the spiral flow of small blood cells through these tiny pipes, and when they start clumping together or the immune system is hyperstimulated by heavy metals, toxins, infectious diseases, or by repeat vaccinations, I'm afraid, or by even by snake venom, then these clumps of cells carrying oxygen, you cannot suck golf balls through straws, and all these small pipes are temporarily blocked, and those most susceptible to the damages are in end blood vessel territories, because in the end blood vessel territories, one thing, they have the lowest flow forces, but on top of that, many of them are in areas, brain and body, that do not have collateral flow, meaning that if you have areas of tissue that have four or five main pipes coming in there, driveways, you can block off two or three and be okay. But in some areas in the body and brain, you're in end vascular territories, we call them watersheds, meaning there is no collateral circulation. So if you impair flow through these critical singular driveway areas, you start losing functions. And that's what we've been able to show. We can show very conclusively across all these infectious diseases, including heavy metal toxicity and diabetes and polio and bubonic plague and leprosy and every vaccine from infancy to adulthood is inducing these same silent end blood vessel damages in the brain, creating measurable neurological features, part of the standard neurological exam that we can now measure before after vaccine and say, oh my gosh, what are we doing here?
Is inflammation part of this?
Well, inflammation is a generic term. Inflammation is a response of the body to healing any damaged tissue. But going back in the literature from the 1960s and 1950s, we'd find that various disease processes, including German measles or rubella panencephalitis, or for that matter, measles encephalitis, you would see the pathological changes, and people would die or develop various neurodevelopmental disabilities, including schizophrenia. But there's no sign of any inflammation whatsoever. And even in children who are dying of sudden instant death after vaccination, again, we see no signs of inflammation, and we have really no cause of death. And same thing happening after Gardasil adversity for the teen girls now. The problem here is that the human body, as you're clearly aware, is chemical, is biomechanical, as well as electrical. And Western medicine focuses entirely on the chemical side because we can create drugs or vaccines and sell them en masse for profit. But we're ignoring two fundamental key areas of the human physiology, and one is a biomechanical problem, a flow problem. And when you impair flow, blood flow, even microscopically, there doesn't have to be any inflammation involved. Basically, it's basically a temporary or permanent or transient blockage of blood flow in the brain that causes damages without any sort of like signs of inflammation. So unfortunately, in the sudden infant death children, by example, or teenage girls from Gardasil, or in the Gulf War vets for that matter. The problem is that when the cause of death in life is impaired microscopic blood flow, that when you bring the person to autopsy and look for cause of death, you will find no cause of death because in all of us, no microscopic blood flow is there in death as it was in life to kill the person, and that's how we're missing it, and that's why we haven't seen it. But inflammation sometimes and sometimes not is involved.
Wow. We're going to be taking calls. Our call-in number is 347-850-1407, 347-850-1407. I will put that out in an announcement again. We do have a few questions that's come in on the chat, and one of them is about Gardasil. Our school intimidates us and scared us into taking the Gardasil shots. I've had two. Now I'm being pressured to come back for the third. What should I do?
In the medical literature, addressing the pressures that are put on society as a whole through propaganda and mass marketing is something that's outside the realm of any medical truth to actually directly address. It's unfortunately the zeitgeist sign of the times what we live in. Direct-to-consumer advertising overwhelms the entire medical profession now, as well as this big pharma, as well as the laws of the land that lobbyists successfully lobby the governments to impose laws that they think they're doing the greater good. But from the point of view of Gardasil, this is crucial here. When we learned that every infectious disease, snake bites included, as well as all these diagnostic labels, are showing the same common neurovascular damages that were always there silently, but we can now measure, we realize that we now have a set of biomarkers that are very specific in the wiring of the nervous system relative to end blood vessel territories to show damages and predict disease or disorder emerging. But we realize since you have a common set of damages across the board, irrespective of the trigger, and irrespective of the end diagnostic label that came out, that was the first basic flattening of the entire Western-based medical model that germs cause disease. If germs cause disease, then they wouldn't be all causing the exact same damage for everybody. It must be something the body's doing in response to these foreign things in the body, which makes sense. Penicillin can kill you, it's not a germ. Peanut butter will kill you, not a germ. And asbestos, a fiber, will cause mesothelioma, lung cancers, not a germ. Something the body's doing generically in response to foreign things, and it is, seems to be the mechanism to pathology. But looking at Gardasil, once we had the neurological measures to go look at this problem, we were seeing in the teenage girls after vaccination with Gardasil 1, 2, or 3, those who are dying or those who are having adversity, including intermittent paralysis, we realized we're seeing the same damages on them and vascular neurologically as we're seeing in the children who are developing autism, ADHD, or learning disabilities, or going down the sudden infant death after childhood vaccines. So with the teenage girls, because we can do this by basically applying a neurological cranial nerve exam to pictures, we went back and looked at the childhood pictures, and sure enough, the same damages we were seeing measurable after Gardasil, we went back to the childhood pictures, and they were happening after each childhood vaccine. They're kind of like silent, transient, we call it ischemic strokes, microscopic impairments to damages that were emerging to the through the pipes to the brain that were added after each childhood vaccine, but they didn't develop a diagnosis of autism or ADHD or learning disabilities, but Gardasil triple shots finished the job in the teenage years, creating the same pathological damages as we saw with childhood vaccines. So the damages are additive. It's silent. It can be immediate. It can be waxing and waning, and they're cumulative over time with every vaccination. So there's no such thing as a safe vaccine. So we're trading prevention for whatever is marketed to us for the greater good in exchange for our health in very profound ways that we're all being damaged silently that adds up over time to create pathology. And so Gardasil, unfortunately, the science now says none of these are safe. So that's an individual decision right now until the medical system and the politics of the world we live in catches up to the medical science here. But as you said when you first opened the show, you're dealing with a trillion-dollar industry here that, one, will be held accountable for what they've done across the planet, two, can't sell their products anymore safely, and this becomes a corporate boardroom decisions now rather than within the best interest of society as a whole.
This so much explains why the symptoms are so erratic and they really can't pin it down. They just didn't look in the right place. And that's why one kid has this problem and the next one has this one. This is just incredible. So you would recommend to this girl, don't take the third one, and what can she do to detoxify the other two?
Unfortunately, the heavy metals in here, whether the system wants to agree with it or not, aluminum is very, very contributory to the problem. The blood in the human body carries things in suspension, not solution. So, by example, if you mix sugar into water, you create a solution. The sugar and water molecules bind together as one molecule. That's a solution. But in the blood, things don't mix that way. The blood is 95% water. The body is 75% water by weight, and the brain is 99% water by molecule. But the blood in the human body carries things in suspension, not solution, and that means all amino acids, all heavy metals, all proteins, and including the red blood cells and the various other elements in the blood, is carried there in suspension. And things are carried in suspension by negative charge. And negative charge, apologize for that, and negative charge, unfortunately, involves carrying things in suspension by more negative it is, more carrying capacity it has. And more negative is it keeps things separated, so red blood cells do not stick together and clump things up. But when that negative charge drops, and aluminum, which has a +3 charge, has 64 times the capacity to do this, things start sludging up and impairing blood flow. So one of the ways by which to detoxify, if you will, is to bring that negative charge back to where it's supposed to be. In all animals and all plants, the negative charge, it's called zeta potential, and people can go look this up in Wikipedia or on the internet. The more negative it is, the more separation you have in elements held in suspension, which is critical for forward blood flow through small pipes, as well as the more carrying capacity you have to carry things out, kind of like a sponge. More negative is more sponge carrying capacity, and you get rid of things this way. So we actually right now use some crystals to kind of like put negative batteries in the body that increases the negative charge to be able to carry more and to be able to detox, if you will, that way, but also to keep things separated so that they don't sludge together, and we call that mass flow to life.
I wonder why people haven't started threatening you or shooting at you, because what you have just said on this show is certainly going to curtail profits. One of the things is just going to show the U.S. as buffoons for insisting on this. There's such sneaky things going on. One of our people just wrote us in and says, Obama declared a national emergency about swine flu, and this eliminates the possibility that anyone can be compensated for damage from the special fund that was set up for just that purpose, a fund that's paid out millions in damages, all the while they claim there are no damages. So that was pretty smart of the U.S. government in bed with Big Pharma. Charge people millions, but find a way around paying any damages, even from the fund that's already set up. You are a threat to these people.
Well, it's not so much a threat. The truth is always a threat to anything, but when you throw government and corporations and big dollars behind it, then you're not really a threat, because you really are David against a series of Goliaths that one singular voice or a series of voices really can't make a difference here, because the system has evolved where the medical system and the medical doctors used to be above the pharmaceutical companies, but the power differential has changed over the last 50-100 years, and pharmacy pretty much directs the show. But the people in pharmacy and the direct consumer advertising and boards and MBA-trained marketers really don't have any understanding or knowledge of medicine or basic physiology. And unfortunately, the basics here in human physiology are not taught in medical schools anymore, so even the doctors are blind to this very process. But you're not really a threat until a lot of people begin listening to you. But from our point, looking forward here, to be able to show everybody to see with their own eyes, because much of society is not trained in scientific methods or statistical, probabilistic, mathematical models that we use as the end-all, be-all truth. Society as a whole doesn't know how to interpret that data. It's a very small subset of the population, and these are individuals telling us things are safe or not. However, when you can put out there and show everybody, which is what we have achieved, and we put the information on our BrainGuardMD.com website as well as VacTruth.com, you can see for yourself, and you go back and look with your own eyes and understanding, say, wait a minute here, they said they were safe, but they weren't measuring this, but now I can see with my own eyes, we've all been harmed, and we're being harmed, and then that's the threat to the system, is that the people waking up and understanding and standing together and saying, no, this is not right. But there's no incentive from the corporate side here to go do that. Who wants to jeopardize their own job or their own marketing or their own products by saying we're causing harm, we're going to get sued, and we can't sell us anymore? Society has evolved in a way that we accept truth blindly from people we believe to be having the end-all be truth. And, you know, there's no real great conspiracy here. People generally think that they're doing the greater good. And to some respect, vaccinations have done a greater good, but they weren't the end-all, be-all answer here. And now that we see there's a common mechanism beneath them, then we realize that we've caused more harm than good here, and now we need to move forward collectively as a whole. And society needs to wake up and say, we need to move out of this realm of this basic, this nonsense here, and actually deal with the core problem, because we're making ourselves all sick. So that's the threat.
Dr. Moulton, you you mentioned that some of the damage is silent and cumulative, but you know, many people that I speak with, you know, aren't interested in hearing these things, or they've vaccinated their children and they don't see any problems. Are some people, is the damage just below the threshold where it is causing problems?
Yeah, great question, actually. Well, there's a couple problems here to answer that question. One, the microscopic blood vessels in the body are at the micron level. So, by example, a single strand of hair is 100 microns in diameter. Capillaries in the body, the 60,000 miles of pipes you have, are 5 microns in diameter. A micron is a millionth of a meter, and the red blood cells are 7 microns in diameter. The red blood cells carrying oxygen are actually bigger than the small pipes you must squeeze through single file to go drop off oxygen tissue. The white blood cells in the body that respond to infectious diseases or foreign things in the body, or heavy metals for that matter, are like 10 to 15 microns in diameter. They're actually big golf balls that do not bend. But our best resolution for the neuroimaging tools that we have, using an MRI, by example, MRIs can only see down to 1 millimeter in structure. So this problem here physiologically is an order of magnitude beneath our best contemporary imaging. Even angiograms of the brain, we cannot see all this microscopic blood flow. So one, we cannot see the problem. So if we cannot see it, we basically deny that it exists. And all those who are being harmed, and we are all being harmed, I'm afraid, even at the injection sites for vaccinations, it's very painful. And we've normalized that. But the pain at the injection site, like a bee sting, is coming from blockages of the small capillaries, blood vessels, and lack of oxygen tissue, like a heart attack, is very, very painful. But what happens locally can also happen systemically. And depending where the individual's physiology is at that moment, relative to the antigens that were injected into them, relative to the cumulative load they've received over time, because from what we can see, it appears that the same areas are repetitively damaged until finally there's a breaking point reached. That everyone's being harmed, whether you see it or not, and the diagnostic labels that can emerge are across every organ system, but by analogy, with 60,000 miles of capillaries in the body, there are some common areas to all of us that are damaged each time silently, but it can be happening in the bowel, the liver, the kidney, the brain, which is why we see in Crohn's colitis or autistic enterocolitis, there's multiple skip lesions throughout the bowel. Dr. Andrew Wakefield was shown this in 1997, but these skip lesions are all in end vascular territories, much like the end vascular territories are causing damages to the brain that we now see neurologically in immediately, prospectively, or retrospectively looking back 100 years ago. So everyone's being harmed where that diagnostic label comes up, and eventually something will break, and we can call it dementia in the elderly population, we can call it autism in the children, we can call it chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, we can call it any disease label you want, because it's all showing the same damages that ischemic strokes to the brain cause. It's only caused by impaired blood flow.
Our switchboard is lighting up like crazy. I'm going to take a call now, and this is the person whose phone number ends with 5605. 5605, you're on the air. Do you have a comment or question?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, yes. This is Janet Leary. I have a question for Dr. Molden. In the past, he has talked about vaccines dampening down the specific immune response to that particular bug, germ, or toxin, but also at the same time, the vaccines are designed to accelerate the nonspecific immune response. Can he talk a little bit about that nonspecific immune response and if us as bioacoustic practitioners can be given some guidelines for biochems or any markers that we can look for in that nonspecific immune response that seems to override this whole issue?
Great question. Dr. Molden.
Fantastic question, I'm completely oblivious, I'm afraid, to nutrition because I'm a medically trained doctor as well as bioacoustics, I'm afraid. But here, to get to the core of the question, the immune system has two separate arms to it, by and large. You have an antibody arm and a nonspecific immune system arm, the neutrophils and T cells and macrophages. But they're called the specific and nonspecific immune system for two different reasons. Any foreign antigen you put in your body, the body can create antibodies targeted specifically at that antigen. And antibodies in the human body are kind of like oil slicks that go and coat cells, whether it's a foreign thing in your body or your own cells have been affected, and kind of mark them for easier destruction by the nonspecific immune system. The vaccines have been designed to enhance antibodies, oil slicks, if you will, to have a memory that if you ever see that antigen again anywhere, that your body will mount a very quick response and eradicate it. But the nonspecific immune system, by analogy, it doesn't care what's in the body. If it's foreign, it goes out there and destroys it. So by analogy, the antibody response is kind of like the cavalry that sort of like weakens down the enemy. And the nonspecific immune system, the neutrophils and white blood cells from that end, are kind of like grunt soldiers that have a 12-hour half-life. They're designed to go to war, kill, and be killed in the process. And you have, and this whole a system usually works in tandem in a homeostatic balance with each other. But when you partially paralyze one, and there's a condition which is called immunological tolerance, which is one of the DVDs we've created called Tolerance Lost or Tolerance Found. We saw this in 1964 with German measles in the 1964 rubella, which is German measles, birth defect evaluation project, which came out of New York University Medical Center. A doctor there named Stella Chess was looking at this, that we had about 20,000 women across the United States who were exposed to German measles in the first trimester of pregnancy. Now, the body doesn't acquire the ability to determine what is self-antigen from foreign antigen until about 3 months of age, and then the system becomes self-aware. And any antibody in the body at that time that is self-reacting, it gets terminated by two ways. It's called immunological tolerance. It's either turned off, which is called energy. You can have the antibodies. They're just kind of like bullets that will never fire. Or they're energized, meaning that they're deleted. Because your body's protecting yourself from inducing an autoimmune response where your own antibodies attack your own tissue. But once you are in that tolerant state, if you ever lose that tolerance, then you can also start destroying and attacking your own body. And unfortunately, the human body does not distinguish between cells that are or tissue that's damaged by a fungus, a bacteria, heavy metal, a parasite, or virus, or for that matter, ongoing ischemia from impaired microcirculation blood flow. The bottom line is tissue is being damaged, and the immune system is going to react in its own way to create antibodies against that tissue to do its job to clean it up. Antibodies come in first, and then the nonspecific immune system comes in like the soldiers to go clean up the damage and finish the job. But ongoing ischemia to any tissue area, whether it's the cables lining the white matter tracts in the brain or body, you can create an autoimmune disorder like multiple sclerosis. So we're even seeing people like, for example, Montel Williams, who's been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. He's showing the exact same neurological damages from impaired and vascular territories as we see after each childhood vaccine. Same way Ronald Reagan showed it with dementia. Same way Marilyn Monroe, unfortunately, showed it before she killed herself in the 1950s, and so do many other individuals out there who we thought, you know, we have all these different diagnostic labels here. But the immune system works in tandem with each other, and artificially changing it in these ways by impairing problems in terms of basic blood flow, we actually are inducing autoimmune disorders as well as basically paralyzing the immune system. But when it loses that uncoupling, and then the paralyzed, the tolerance is lost, then all of a sudden you can start damaging tissue by ongoing ischemia, which is an autoimmune disorder, whether it's antibodies or not, and that leads to pathology. So how to address that bioacoustically or have markers for that, I can't directly speak on that, because the markers I use are tattooed specifically to understanding the wiring of the brain and its functions relative to end blood vessel territories. And that's how we created the measures and the ability to show people what's been going on across all vaccinations. How to translate that understanding into markers outside of the basic neurology, I haven't gotten to that point yet. And for that matter, apologetically, I wouldn't even know how to begin to start to do that. So I try to stick with what I know and what I can show scientifically and empirically to the world. And once the information is picked up on a greater scale, then perhaps other more people who have greater knowledge in other areas will see a way to integrate the two to develop more markers for this problem and ways to intervene than what we already have right now.
We have a computer program called blood clotting. I would really like to see a combination, a partnership of some kind, with you looking at people and us doing their vocal print and seeing what the blood clotting issues are. We've got stuff in there for all the fibrins and proteins and even the genetics of this. You know, on this show, I thought it was going to be appropriate to talk about our pre-vaccination program, which we want to offer to people, a free class about that. But I think the blood clotting one, and Janet, you own that program, don't you?
Yes, I do.
So,
and also the neurological things that he is talking about, I don't think that he is aware, but we have the markers and we have all the neurological frequency equivalents, and that's what I was specifically looking for, to see if, besides the blood clotting, if there would be any specific neurological neurotransmitters or anything that lights up like a Christmas tree when this starts happening, besides just the immune response also.
Wonderful, great point here. So going back in the medical literature and looking at specifically the autistic children, because autism basically is the same as every other one of these diagnostic labels in one form or another, the empirical literature has found biomarkers, if you will, nonspecific, in the urine that reflect activation of the inside linings of the blood vessel walls. We call that the endothelium, markers of platelet aggregation, as well as markers of oxidative stress. But we were realizing that this is a problem with these small microvessels. The 1964 rubella birth defect evaluation project showed the same neurological features in the faces of these children who were dying from the prenatal exposures, with no inflammation, by the way, as we're seeing currently now. And it was involved in all basically locking down of end microscopic blood vessels, brain and body, every organ system imaginable. But the markers that are out there in the urine metabolites can be used. However, they're nonspecific. And what is specific here, what we can now show, is that if you can take an X-ray of your arm today, and you say the bone is not broken, then I whack it with a baseball bat and bring you back the next day or 3 or 4 days later and find the arm is broken, then that's proof causation. You can do that 10,000 times to infants, teens, or adults and say baseball bats to arms break bones. But now we can also do the same in the here and now, or retrospectively going back 50 years ago if parents have pictures of the children, or a video for that matter, and we can show, look, neurologically, the nervous system was intact. But then you vaccinated like a baseball bat, and the next day or week later, here you have broken nervous system, and you can only cause those damages by impairing blood flow. As simple as that. So that's proof causation again. And when we saw the same damages from infancy to adulthood, irrespective of the end diagnostic label coming out, it was proof causation. The people can now see for themselves and see with their own eyes. So that is something observable. But this is not clotting in the classic forms of the blood vessel clotting cascades, although fibrin and fibrinogen is involved at times. Medicine sees clots from being formed to cause strokes by emboli, little pieces that break off somewhere and go get lodged in smaller pipes, or thrombus, like a clot formed at a site in a blood vessel. But this is called agglomeration. The technical term for it in colloidal chemistry is called flocculation, and this is occurring as a function of the negative charge in the body called zeta potential, that when the charge drops, things start sludging together. And negative charge in the carrying capacity of the blood is kind of like water in freezing points, that you can have great changes in the water temperature with no change in the structure of water, but when you get very close to the freezing point, then a small degree of temperature change can lead to crystallization and changing in the structure of the water. Same thing with negative charge in the blood and the blood's fluids, that you can have large changes in negative charge upwards towards the upper end of this charge part. But when you get down close to minus 15 millivolts, then that's kind of like the phase change where you can go from fluid to gel, and gel doesn't go through pipes. You can't suck gel or sludge through small pipes. It just doesn't work. So this is what's causing this problem. But the immune side of this as well is also inducing clotting, not clotting in terms of the classic sense of it, but impaired forward flow through the pipes. And the pipes are still active, but all the side channels are being deprived of forward flow. And that means no oxygen tissue, and that's basically setting up for disease, because germs like to hang out places where the immune system cannot get to them. So if you're impairing flow, you're also impairing the movement of the immune system to those areas, and germs or heavy metals will hang out in areas and vascular territories where they cannot be eradicated. And the white blood cell response to these areas is also serially blocking these pipes and creating further impairments of flow, because white blood cells roll through the blood vessels on the inside walls as a function of flow forces behind them. Decrease those flow forces, and the white blood cells jam up like a bunch of logs in a river, and all of a sudden you've got more agglomeration and more flocculation and no forward flow through these side pipes, and the occupants of the tissue are starved, and germs and heavy metals will hang out there, and you can't get rid of them. It's the roads to Rome and the roads leaving Rome that are damaged, and everyone is diagnosing Rome like there's a problem. No one's focusing on the transportation system, which is basic physiology and blood flow.
I can feel a research project here. If we would combine our databases, our biomarkers of Alzheimer's, seizure disorders, pre-vaccination, and blood clotting, then look at these urine markers, I think we can look at this and try to undo it. Incredible.
Yeah, absolutely right here, because what we've been missing across all of medicine is a means to measure not only what we're doing to cause disease, but also to measure something in response to therapeutic interventions to go try and fix the problem. But we didn't know what problem to fix. And when all of medical system and the medical experts are trained as ivory tower specialists in their own areas, I haven't gone out there and created any new knowledge. The knowledge was always there all along, but it was across multiple different areas of physiology, of clinical medicine, of chemistry, colloidal chemistry, of physics. And until you went down from those ivory tower positions, you came down and started putting the link and basically creating the fitting in this missing autism puzzle piece across the existing knowledge base, and all of a sudden the answers were there. And it's kind of like building a bridge, that now we can drive understanding and truth across, but now we have that bridge connected, that we can also use that understanding and knowledge to monitor the effects, beneficial or otherwise, of things we're thinking we're doing to make things better or worse. But establishing causation is point one, and that's what we have done. Establishing a common mechanism across all these disease labels is step two, and now step three would be to go validate it and have the peer review published so the world can go see what we've accomplished here, and then now wake up and understand we have more tools to work with now to go validate the things that we are doing that Western medicine says is quackery. Well, unfortunately, Western medicine has done the best job it can, but unfortunately, Western medicine, by its current methods and technologies and limited understanding, has created strokes for everybody, all these diseses. So,
have you written a book about this where people can get more information?
Oh my gosh! Well, it's in the pipeline to do. I've joined with a group down in Fort Lauderdale by the Sea in Florida called Bright Steps Forward. It's a not-for-profit organization designed to raise funds to help children and adults who have various neurological disorders. I've been so busy running around. I put all my work first before the Federal Circuit Courts in the United States last October, and I spent all my time basically the last several years accumulating that, but that's sitting there right now. They know in your Human Health Service Commission, because their lawyers come and represent the Federal Vaccine Courts, they know I've shown this problem is real and it's undeniable. But when you come into the court system with the glove that says O.J. Simpson's guilty, then the lawyers from the other side have only two options. They have to prevent the evidence from coming to court, or they have to destroy the messenger bringing it in. And it's got nothing to do with the truth. But they still come out there with these mass vaccine schedules, because even H1N1, for that matter, I'm sorry, I'll get to answer your question in a second, it caused the same swine flu vaccines in 1976, caused all these cases of Guillain-Barre syndrome, and Guillain-Barre syndrome is showing the same palsies from in-basket territory damages after vaccinations in 76 as every childhood vaccine does, adult vaccine does. So putting the information in the court system was a way to curtail this quickly, because unless you hold those who are profiting from it accountable, nothing will change. Vioxx from Merck Frost caused heart attack and stroke that killed 10,000 people. But even as physicians, when we knew it was causing heart attack and stroke in 2002, it wasn't until the FDA pulled Vioxx from the market in 2004 that we ever said, okay, it causes heart attack and stroke. But Merck Frost still gets away profiting from these things, because they give $5 billion out there, say, here, everyone go get your piece of pie here and leave us alone. But whether it's Gardasil or MMR or any other vaccine out there causing the same damage, it's not about the truth here. It's about profits. And so my information is there in the courts, but now I need to find the time to sit down and actually write this, not only for the scientific community, but also for the lay community to understand. And those are works in progress that, thankfully, with the help of people in Florida and other places, I'm going to get the time to sit down and do this. But you have to understand that no one wants to fund or support the type of research I have done and do. I received 27 scholarships for academic or research excellence over all my years of academia. I was graduating valedictorian in every program I was in. But I can't get a red dime to go look at vaccines, so I had to do it all on my own. It basically bankrupts you pretty much, because you can't get funding for it, but you can get $1 million to go look at genetics. But so finding the group or people who would sit down and really want to look at this for the greater good has been a hard thing to do, but I have found such a group, and I'm pleased to be associated with that. And over the upcoming months, 6 months probably, I would say, I'll get a book out there that shows this to society as a whole. And we're putting information up on our website, and if people really want to see the truth, they just go to our website. We have now a two-hour video out there that actually shows it across the world. Here you go. Here's the problem across all your diseases and disorders. But if you don't take the time to learn and understand what's going on with your own eyes, then don't listen to what Dr. Molden says or the Centers for Disease Control says or anyone else says. Go look and understand yourself, because if you do not understand, then you're going to be sold a bill of goods based on other people's understanding, which may not be the truth. You have to understand yourself. Seek and you shall find.
Sherry, can I ask a question?
Well, we have several. We have two online. We have one on hold. Chris, that was you and Janet. You each have questions.
I'd just like to make a comment. Dr. Molden, as he was saying, doesn't have a book, but he does have a DVD series, The Tolerance Lost, which is available on his website, and I would recommend that people would watch that as a resource that does have quite a bit of information in it.
And the question I have very quickly, he was mentioning about aluminum creating a positive charge in the blood flow, and then the use of crystals to retain the negative charge. I was just kind of wondering how you use the crystals, and if possibly something that is biochemical like silicon or something of that sort, can that be used to balance off the positive charge from the aluminum and from the other items that create the aluminum, I mean the positive charge in the blood flow?
This is all called colloidal chemistry, and people can go look up. A colloid is something held in suspension by a negative charge. So, by example, we put aluminum in your antiperspirants that you put under your arm, because aluminum plus 3 charge has 64 times the ability to clog and clump things up. So that's why you don't perspire. We block off the perspiration pores in the arm. But consider this as well. This is not some new knowledge. In all of the water treatment plants across North America, water comes into the water treatment plants dirty and full of all things held in suspension by negative charge. The water looks murky, full of dust, dirt, and heavy metals. as part of the treatment plans. People can go look this up. We put aluminum plus 3 charge into the water, which actually drops the negative charge, causes these things held apart to come together, stick together, become heavier, increase mass, and they sludge to the bottom. It's called slag. And then we scoop the clean water off. But the same thing's happening in the human body. Whether you want to put fluoride in your water, or you want to put aluminum in your vaccines, or you want to cook with aluminum cookingware, aluminum is the worst contributor here. And so the colloidal chemistry is very clear. Various substances either have a 1-to-1, a 1-to-2, or 1-to-3 ratio of its ability to induce sludging or agglomeration or flocculation or reverse it. So we just use the reverse chemistry that people use to drop things in charge to make them more positive, and we make it more negative where God intended to be in our human bodies. But this crystal idea is basically what's normally in your body, but it's based on ratios. If you have more negative batteries than positive batteries in a collection of fluid, then you'll have a net negative charge. But everything we're doing in society, from our processed foods to these things we're putting in the body to the body's normal response to foreign things in it, is all geared towards healing. And healing, as a temporary phase, is designed to drop that positive charge. The blood vessels in the areas being damaged have to close off. We call it self-cauterization. It's all part of healing. But what's causing all these diseases is healing, natural healing, is getting stuck. And one of these mechanisms by doing it is this charge phenomena that's involved in all aspects of healing and basic colloidal chemistry, and the body is one big colloid. 75% water. If your doctors are not talking to you about water, which is much of what your makeup is, then how do we expect them to be able to heal us? They don't understand the basic aspects of healing that gets outside of chemistry and into the basic physiology of the laws that govern our universe, because Newton's second law of motion is force equals acceleration times mass, and that's basically why apples fall from trees. But also in the blood, force is the forward flow, acceleration is the rate of flow, and mass is the substance's weight that's carried in suspension. But if you drop the negative charge, you increase the mass, and then if you increase mass with no increase in force, there's deceleration, no forward flow, and you have hypoxia to all the tissue, setting up for disease and healing gets stuck.
We just need to have you back for a whole series. We have two questions online. They may be quick, and then I've got several callers. Mm-hmm. Do vaccinations have anything to do with the obesity epidemic that we see in very young kids?
Great question. I haven't specifically looked at obesity, or for that matter, eating disorders per se. However, I can say this, that I do understand many of the areas in the brain that are in blood vessel territories that can be selectively derailed by impairing flow. Now, in the basic physiology of animal research, we call this comparative neurosciences, we found that lesions, lesions to an area of the thalamus, which has many end blood vessel territories associated with it, which is why many of these autistic children have sensory integration problems, and they don't like to be touched or hugged, because these end vascular territory damages create a central pain syndrome that they can't tell you, that touch and light touch and walking on the toes or having clothes on is noxious stimuli to the brain. But in areas of the thalamus as well, there's an area called the ventromedial area of the thalamus, and when we lesion that in animals, the animals eat high caloric intake, they become morbidly obese. And you can induce this by ligating the blood vessels, or for that matter, causing specific lesions. So there are areas in the brain that actually involved in things not only for a selection of a mate from a gender to the food and the central thermostats, if you will, for monitoring satiation. So assumptively, they can be damaged here by what we are doing, and it could very well contribute to this problem with overweight stuff. But I cannot say that conclusively, because all I can do is stick with what I can show before or after we do things like vaccinations and measure it neurologically. But it's quite possible that it is causing the same problem.
Okay,
is it also the thalamus affecting or producing a lot of the sound sensitivity that a lot of the autistic kids have?
Great question. The thalamus is the central relay station for all sensory inputs coming up to the cortex of the brain. So, by example, whether you're hearing things or getting sensory information, it comes through there. But it has its own gating mechanisms that you can habituate very readily. So if you take out those habituation mechanisms, then all of a sudden the information is being flooding the cortex. It's like hearing 1,000 voices at once in a room. When you and I go into a room of 1,000 people, we can zero in on, focus on one conversation to the exclusion of others. But when you take out those relays, and you take out the body's ability to go monitor these things, then all the things you hear come up to the brain, which is why these children, autistically, have this maintenance of sameness, and they like to do the same patterns over and over again. And at the same time as well, when they focus on something, they have to narrow in on one singular aspect of it, because all the information, sensory, taste, touch, color, context, movement, is all flooding the brain, and they cannot habituate to these things. So yes, sensitivity to auditory information is overwhelming to them, and they tend to compensate by top-down processing, repetitive obsessive behaviors that actually to us look abnormal, but it's really compensatory from their response, because they're putting the filters on volitionally from the brain top-down, from the cortex rather than from the bottom-up. The buffer's been lost, and the same thing as well. People didn't really understand this, but when the infants are premotor and preverbal, and they just get here in the world, they don't know what the world's about. They can't tell you what's going on. But when you blow out these endvascular territories to the thalamus by these microscopic ischemic strokes post-vaccination, or heavy metals, for that matter, infectious diseases, then it creates what we call in adult neurology a thalamic pain syndrome, which basically, from adult strokes occasionally, the light touch becomes painful and noxious to the brain. And so we're doing comforting things for these children, like trying to hug them. They pull back, but they can't tell you it's painful or harmful. And they take their clothes off and figure that's abnormal. They're basically trying to decrease these stimuli to the brain, and they're walking on their toes because these other sensory stimuli coming in is not pleasant anymore. And so, yes, the auditory sensitivities is likely from the same thing. The reason why schizophrenic patients have auditory hallucinations, not coming out of the blue, you lose these central habituating areas in the thalamus, and your own thoughts come to your brain like someone else talking to you. We call them auditory hallucinations. The journal used to be called the Journal of Autism and Childhood Schizophrenia, but we separated these two labels based on the symptom profiles, not realizing there's a common mechanism here, and one of the mechanisms triggering now is these darn vaccines.
Well, my switchboard here has been starting to flash, and we've lost a couple of callers that had questions, so we didn't hang up on you, just call back. We do have another question from email. This is from an attorney. You have impeccable credentials, but why hasn't your work been peer-reviewed? I think I know the answer to this, but I'd like to hear it from you.
I'm writing it right now, actually. So you have to please understand that to get to the point where I am now, like I knew back in 2002, basically, that these vaccines were causing ischemic strokes, but I had to work through it with my own understanding, because no one wants to be there and go scream fire in the theater when everyone in the theater realizes they're on fire and there's no doors or exits to get them out of there. So that was point one. But at the time, Dr. Bernard Rimland, the founder of the Autism Research Institute and one of the founders of these damn doctors across the United States, was the only one who really knew the true magnitude of my research. But I asked him not to disclose it at that point, because my colleague, Andrew Wakefield, was being crucified by peer review publishing in 97 in Lancet at UK. They basically destroyed his medical career. And so I realized, before I come out here with basically a theory and understanding, I better have the whole thing ducks in a row here and be able to show the whole problem. So I've been running around for the last several years collecting pathological data on my own time and dime, even to your own county coroner's office in the United States, where these children are dead and dying that the vaccines have induced and they have no cause of death. But now that I have all the data and I put it before the federal courts, that was step one. Providing the information to society through the DVD series was step two. And now writing it up for the peer-reviewed journals is step three, so I'm working on that right now. In fact, I'm working on showing the same common problem across all these disease and disorder labels for neurocase reports, because this is what people don't really understand about the scientific methods as well. My background training was in clinical neuropsychology before going into medical school. But clinical neuropsychology is very, very powerful because it used standardized tests and the normal bell curve. And the normal bell curve is what we use scientifically to claim something is 0.05 level of significance. It's scientifically sound. But when you have a normal curve with no variability for measures you use, and the way the eyes move together or the face is symmetrical, the eyes move in tandem together. They're locked together neurologically. And because they have no variance, that if you derail that and you measure before after something, you hit statistical significance immediately with your own eyeballs because you're at the 0.05 level of significance. That's probably probably hard to understand, and I'm sorry I'm brushing through that very quickly. So with that understanding and knowledge to show it across all these disease and disorders, I'm currently writing that right now, but understand no one supports the work I do. So when you have to run around and share information and struggle to survive as a singular David against the Goliath and system, it's a tough process, but I'm doing it anyway. You bankrupt yourself in the process, but putting it out there to peer review is what's happening right now, and ideally by February or March it should be out there for the world to see. But we made it very clearly. Peer review is available right now. They cannot deny this truth. The DVDs show it very conclusively, and we have it on our websites. Go look. but to write it in a format that fits the peer review process, especially when you've used a whole slew of cases before afterwards.
I'm going to have to interrupt you. We have less than a minute left, but if you would stay on the line, we have several other questions here.
Wonderful.
I need to tell people that this is Blog Talk Radio. The show is Breaking the Sound Barriers of Disease. Next week we will have Raylan Allen from Rumor Mill News. She always has great and new information. We hope you tune in to that. If anyone wants to write to us, it's class@vocalprofileinc.com to sign up for these classes we've been talking about for swine flu and pre-vaccination and blood clotting. We'd love to hear from you. Please stay in touch with us. Thank you, Dr. Molden. Thank you, Chris, for being here. And I think we are out of time. But like I said, we are going to stay on the line because there's several other questions about genetics that are very interesting. Okay, we are off the air, but we are still recording. And one of the very important questions that just came in while we were talking is, do these vaccinations and these ischemic strokes you're talking about disrupt our genetic pool?
Yes, both ways, actually. So from what I can see. So here's one of the problems that have emerged. Once we realize that we have these markers now measurable that are core neurological to show these markers of these damages, we realize that, well, we can measure this across the board in many people, but then we started seeing, well, what other disorders and genetic disorders go along with autism?
We have all the microphones open, so anything happening on your end, caller, we're hearing. I'm sorry, Dr. Molden, go ahead.
Yeah, so then we started looking at Down syndrome, trisomy 21. Most of these individuals die in the 30s from dementia. We already knew dementia had markers of autism from the vaccinations. But the Down syndrome children were showing this. Other genetic disorders like tuberous sclerosis goes with autism showed this. Fragile X showed this. Progeria, advanced aging showed this same problem. So we began to realize, hold the phone here, the genetic disorders seem to also be inducing the same core common problem of microcirculation damages as we're seeing after acquired injuries from vaccination. So it really is not a chicken and the egg.
All callers, your mics are open. We're hearing everything that you're doing. Okay, go ahead.
So then being able to see that, then it became, well, what's truly going on here? But the problem that we are missing at this point in the data is that we don't know if these various children with these various neurological disorders had these from birth, or for that matter, they've also been vaccine damaged like everyone else. So right now the conclusion is sort of like tentative. Either the genetic disorders are causing the same problem as the vaccinations, or that the people with genetic disorders are also being harmed by vaccinations as everyone else is. That's a study that needs to be done. But in terms of the genetic derailed instrument, here's the problem as well, is that when...
We are losing you. We can barely hear you.
Sorry, is that better?
A little bit.
Okay, so here's the other problem as well, is that when you... If I took my hands and I strangulated you by blocking your carotid arteries in your neck, after a little while, you'll start thinking not very clearly. You will have confusion, you'll be disoriented, and your brain won't function on all cylinders because you're being deprived of oxygen to your brain. But do that macroscopically, like strangulation, or microscopically in vascular territories, that you have impairments of oxygenation at the tissue level, then all of a sudden your cells will start making derailments and mistakes in their own ongoing processes, and you can actually turn on various genes that are not supposed to be turned on. You can create genetic derailments and damages that actually create genetic problems like mitochondrial disorders after these darn vaccinations, in the same way that we see mitochondrial disorder children having the same neurological damages as vaccines do to everybody. So, this can happen from vaccinations, and you can derail your basic genetics as a process to it, because the genes and the cell's functions in reading its genes need to be able to do these readings in a completely oxygenated, non-strangulated state. So this is possibly true as well. And we've seen, even in some leukemias and infantile spasms that seems to be coming from the vaccinations, that we're also seeing the same sort of like neurological damages. So is leukemia just coincidental to that, or is it also being derailed by microscopic blood flow?
Another question. I understand that Canada has changed its immunization policy. Is this because of your work?
No, Canada is really not in any sort of like rush to change any of its immunization policies. It's the same as it is in the United States by and large. In fact, we're passing laws in Canada. Last fall it was Bill C-51 and 52. Now it's Bill C-6, where it's basically on the road to outlawing most natural health products unless by a prescription drug. And the system here is not much different from the United States. It's usurped by these lobbyists that basically outnumber and outgun our democratically elected officials here. So there is no mass thing to go change our immunization problems here and our immunization schedule here any differently in the United States. But more specifically, we have the same problems as you have. So, by example, when Governor Rick Perry down in Texas received a big donation to his political coffers from a pharmacy, he basically mandated Gardasil for all the teen girls down there across the board. But even in our own government here in Canada, our Prime Minister, Harper, one of his close friends went to go work as a lobbyist for a pharmacy, and then within a month, all of a sudden, there's $300 million Canadian tax dollars going there to promote Gardasil across the country. So my work is not changing any of the system now. When it's peer-reviewed, published, it's not like I change anything rapidly. Medicine has a 15-20-year lag before catching up to things that are said to it. And so we're all in the same boat together, and all I can do is bring truth forward as fast and furious as possible and suffer the consequences for doing so. But at the same time as well, truth wears no mask. The evidence is undeniable, incontrovertible, and in time it'll get caught up to the system in there, and they'll say, okay, fine, in time they'll say, like Christopher Columbus, the world truly is round, not flat, and we'll move on. But until then, we're running around like the world is flat, and we're causing harm to each other by doing so. So I can't change the system faster than it will change itself.
This is a great way to end in this question. They said, you are our hope. Do you see patients? Do you have a clinic? Or do you know of anyone who uses your technique that we can send our children to?
Yes. I am doing the best I can to help right now. But keep in mind that I have to be very, very specific as to what I say. Because I'm coming up with something very, very powerful here that basically goes against the grain of all that we all think and understand, and it threatens the very fabric of the foundations of the Western allopathic medical model and what physicians are trained to do. So, one, I cannot deviate from that straight line in any way, but two, to help people with the knowledge that we have. Right now, you can find Bright Steps Forward, which is brightstepsforward.org, and therapiesforkids.com, which is down in Lauderdale by the Sea. They do schedule for me to see people for assessments, because before we go and try and help someone, we agree on what the problem is. But the problem is not in the diagnostic labels you've already received. The diagnostic labels, from my perspective at this point, is not very helpful, other than labeling something as a specific type of food in a store. I need to go in and show that, well, do I see this problem with the blood flow? Can I show it to the individual or family member? And once we can agree that this is a common problem here, let's go start directing treatment interventions at that. All naturally, by the way, nothing pharmaceutical whatsoever. So to get to myself and the people we work with, we basically, right now, I'm tattooed in Florida, and you can find access to me there. And we're doing our best to bring the information forward so everybody has this knowledge, because directing your own health care should reside in the individual first. And if you are not being directed properly and don't understand what the common problem is, then you'll never be able to hit the bullseye here on the dartboard. You're basically throwing watermelons at dartboards, and sometimes you're lucky you hit the roof.
Great. Marcus Cordes that's on with us is a researcher. He has two children who have these issues. Chris, is this something that you want to set up to go see Dr. Molden and see what can be done with your kids at this clinic? Then we can compare it with bioacoustics.
Yes, it would be very interesting. I'm a big fan of your work, Dr. Molden, and have read everything that and watched everything that you've produced.
Well, thank you.
How can people get in touch with you, or just go to this website and start to set up an appointment there?
Yeah, they can get in touch with Therapies for Kids, which is in Lauderdale by the Sea, or Bright Steps Forward, and they arrange for me to see people with the schedule I have keeping. They've tried to free me up here in the next 2 or 3 months so I can actually write the peer-reviewed stuff, but it's been hard going. You know, the world out there is just slammed. This current recession is making things even more difficult here, but we're doing the best we can to move forward as fast as we can and to be able to find the time to be able to provide help to those who are generally seeking it. But no one seeks help unless you know what they need help for. But coming to see us is probably the best first step at this point. So therapiesforkids.com or brightstepsforward.org, you can get to us through there, or even emailing me at Dr. Molden, spelled Dr. Molden, at brightstepsforward.org. One way or another, we'll get in touch with people, and they'll be able to arrange for us to do some consults and be able to write up for you and show you, well, this is the problem. You see for yourself. But once you have that, then you also have a common denominator to go look at and say, well, here's where the original problem originated in. Here's the markers for it. So from this point forward, if we're not fixing these problems that you can now see and measure, then nothing we're doing is helping. And this is what everyone needs to see, because right now everyone's being gouged from every sort of like snake oil salesman in the book, from thousands of dollars of supplements to month to every kind of intervention whatsoever, and no one's helping the core problem. Some of these things are making things worse, but unless you can measure it and see it, you have no idea if you're doing the greater good or the greater harm here, and so we need to first establish that.
Well, you're certainly putting a new face on medicine. Our office will be in touch with you and about doing other shows with us and getting this information out, and also about working with some of the kids that you're seeing.
Wonderful. Well, I apologize for speaking so much here, but I thank you very much for the opportunity to address your audience. And together, collectively as a whole, with understanding, we'll reach this 100th monkey syndrome, and we'll change the face of the future for the children and all of us. And I'm sure it's doable, because truth wears no mask. And we have truth to offer. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Dr. Molden. And most of our callers have fallen off here because there was really some trouble on the line. So we'll end the show, and we'll stay in touch.
All right. God bless. Bye-bye.